You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
So this is the panel that's always a burden for the moderator because it's the end of the day and people want to leave to beat the traffic home and so on. But this is actually a really important topic, and I'm glad at least you're staying. The first panel, I think, addressed the direction and dynamics and pace of political change in China. The second one that we just had looked at some of the tensions in this process with respect to succession and the alignment or misalignment of economic strategy and political system. And then within the ruling party. Now we're going to talk about state-society relations. I think this really is the litmus test of political development and political system. As Professor Zhang said in the Q&A, it's really at the local level, at the state-society interaction, that the party faces its problems. And, you know, one can throw out a couple of different questions in thinking about state and society. Are we talking about a strong state or a weak state? A strong society or a weak society? What are the dynamics of these different combinations? Second, I think you'd expect that between state and different parts of society, you're going to have different modes of interaction. So in China, for example, the Communist Party looks at workers differently than it looks at students. And finally, there's the issue of the institutionalization of state-society interaction, and here the issue of interest groups comes up. We have three outstanding panelists, you have their bios, so I'm not going to go over them. I hope they won't mind, but we are under a little bit of time pressure. And the first presenter will be Professor Shi Huaxing of the Department of Public Administration at the Chinese Academy of Governance. Then we will have Mary Gallagher from University of Michigan, and then Professor Jing Yuejin of Tsinghua University. So, Professor Shi.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great honor and privilege for me to present here. My presentation entitled State Building, Society Building, and Trust Building in Contemporary China. This is a syllogism of state and society relations. And within every part, every syllogism, there is still a small syllogism, that is why, how, and what to go. So my presentation is in three parts. The first part is state building, an untangible plot. The second part is society building, an unleashing zone. The third part is trust building, an unbounded mission. Let's look at the first part, state building, an untangled plot. Okay. As what I mentioned, a small syllogism is why, how, and where to go. Why political order matters? That's my first question. If we answer the question why political order matters, I think we have to look back, to look at the beginning rather than the end of political development in China. We can easily find that making constitutional work has been the principal issue for 100 years. From nation building to state building, what epitomized the aspects of political development in China is seeking for order. Without political order, it's impossible for political development. Therefore, reform is a process of order rebuilding. to some extent, along with the state building in the past 30 years. History matters. If we look back history, we can see China experienced a weakened state during the first half of 20th century. Political order has played a key role in the state formation since 1949. State autonomy shaped the reality of access of different groups to political power. Political order also matters a lot in state building subsequently after 1978. Deng Xiaoping put stability to a dominant position to ensure reform and opening up policy and to avoid massive disorder like the Cultural Revolution. So we can see the order, political order in history is very important in China. Since most of us are scholars, I put some quotation from other scholars about the importance of order. So the second question or first part is how state building proceeds. We can see from different periods of time. The first period is during 1950s. After 100 years of war, the first task of the new regime was to establish political order. State formation began in 1949 with the convening of the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, that is CPPCC, with the convening of that. And then thereafter, China reached its high point of state building in 1954 by the opening of the National People's Congress, that is NPC. The Constitution of People's Republic of China was adopted at the first session of NPC in 1954. It is a milestone in the history of state building. A new political order began under the 1954 Constitution. However, making Constitution work is not easy. Before reform and opening up, the erroneous theory and practice of taking class struggle as a key link create great disorder in China, and this made the 1975 Constitution and 1978 Constitution dysfunctional. The current Constitution was comprehensively revised by the NPC in 1982 after the reform and opening up. Subsequently, the NPC partially amended the Constitution for occasions in 1988, 1993, 1999, and 2004. Chapter 1 of the 1982 Constitution set up the general principles of state building. In the 30 years since 1982 Constitution, state rebuilding has brought much progress of order in the field of politics, economy, and society. Institutionalization is one of the biggest strides. The system of People's Congress, which is the basic political system of China, is at the core of institutionalization. This system is the guarantee of state order. As China developed, the system is surely to be improved and developed. According to the 1982 Constitution, the National People's Congress and the local People's Congress of at all levels are the organs through which the people exercise the state power. This is a brief picture of the state political structure in China. If you want to know more in detail, you can read the Constitution. Within the system of People's Congress, NPC is the highest state body and the only legislative house in the People's Republic of China. altogether, there are five central and local levels of a People's Congress at the present. In addition to the NPC, there are Congress of provinces or of cities without divided into district, and also of cities. The first level is NPC, the second level is province, the third level is Congress of cities divided into districts, and the fourth level is Congress of cities not divided into districts, and then the fifth level is Congress of townships. Totally, there are five levels of Congress. This is the very basic framework. According to the 1982 Constitution, the function of and the power of National People's Congress include to amend the Constitution and oversee its enforcement, to enact and amend basic laws governing criminal offenses, civil affairs, state organs, and other matters, to elect and appoint members to central state organs and to determine major state issues. That means there are at least four powers. The first is legislative power. The second is delegating authority. The third is policy formation, formulation. And the fourth is supervision of governing organs. These are the function and powers. As a term, maybe a lot of us heard before, a so-called rubber stamp used to describe the NPC's function. Nevertheless, changing from rubber stamp to iron stamp is the real process made in the past 30 years. One of the important efforts was made in 2003. About 19 NPC Standing Committee full-time members elected. And this is one of the important measures to strengthen function of the People's Congress. And if you look at the website, you can find during this year's session of People's Congress, the Wall Street Journal, the blocks of Wall Street Journal published an article titled National People's Congress, Not Just Rubber Stamp Session. You can find it. And the latest episode of strengthening NPC's role is last month. In China nowadays, personal income tax is undergoing a reform. The State Council submits a proposal aimed to raise the personal income tax threshold from 2,000 Chinese yuan, it's almost to 300 U.S. dollars, to 3,000 Chinese yuan. During the bi-monthly session in April, the NPC Standing Committee examined the proposals for the first time. Instead of voting on it, the Standing Committee chose to re-examine it. I think this denotes something, some enhancement of NPC's power, and elucidate how the NPC is working now. So besides this, nowadays in China, something openly counting and objections to, and some abstentions is real in process. So that's something about the NPC work itself. And besides this, we can find something else. One is rule of law. It's set up the norms of state building in modern society. Just like Professor Yu Keping mentioned, within the 30 years of reform, the Chinese authority has devoted great effort to enhance rule of law. I don't want to repeat so much about this, but what I want to mention is in 1997, the 15th CPC National Congress described decided to make the rule of law basic strategies and building a socialist country under the rule of law. Then in 1999 amendments, the People's Republic of China exercised the rule of law, building a socialist country governed according to law was added to the constitution. And then in 2004 amendment, the state respect and guarantee human rights was joined into the constitution. And for the first time, the constitution announced something like the state, in accordance with law, protects the rights of citizens to private property and to the inheritance. This is the first time in the history of the People's Republic of China. So during the fourth session of the 11th National People's Congress in 2011, top legislator Wu Bangguo announced that a socialist system of law, which Chinese characteristic has been formed based on the situation and reality in China. So this is ushering a new chapter in China's effort to promote rule of law. In addition to rule of law, one more thing I want to mention is election. Election is the institutionalized bridge to connect state and citizens. The PRC's first election law was put in place in 1953. And then in 1982, 1986, 1995, and 2004, the second, the third, and fourth set of amendments were adopted. What I want to stress is the fifth amendment of election law, which adopted in 2010. 2010 amendments provide for equal representation of citizens, regardless of rural or urban status. This means that urban and rural people will enjoy equal electoral rights. This is a great further step. You know, I grown up in rural area. I deeply know, you know, the representation is really was really different in those years. You know, in 1995, the ratio was about 4-1, and now after 2010, the amendment we can has the same issue, same ratio. So this is a big progress, I think. Then where the state building to go, I just want to mention a little bit. I think the big problem or the key issue of political in China is the first paragraph I put here. And it's integrating the leadership of the ruling party, the position of people as the master of the country, and the rule of law. The three things is quite different, but how to put them together and how to set up mechanism to integrate them is very important in China. And the second is mechanism turn the party's position into will of the state through legal procedures is being explored now in China, but we still have a long way to go. And then the third thing is let the Congress from soft to hard. I already mentioned something has been done, but we still have a long way to go. And then I think one matter is important. What I mentioned is representation matters. In terms of People's Congress itself, the prevalent concern of soft and hard stamp issued is only in respect of legislation and supervision. Representation, however, is still ahead of reconsideration. Representative function of People's Congress is associated with the position of people as a matter of the country, reflecting the relationship between the MPC and its citizens. In addition to carrying out the election law, making deputies to People's Congress exercise their function and powers in accordance with the law, and maintaining close ties with the general public is more important. Besides, one more thing I want to say is the government has also to take the responsibility for cooperation from other organizations for participation of the public. That's the first part. The second part is society building and unleashing zone. The first question, why society building? By society building, what I'm going to cover is the aspects of social development beyond state building. That is, 社会建设, 社会管理, means social construction or social building, social administration or social management. Now it's becoming a very hot topic in today's China. Professor Ken Liberso raised a question more than 10 years ago. How has reform and the political evolution changed the nature of the ties that connect the society to the state? There are many ways to answer it, of course. I would like to answer it through the way of bringing society back in. If we bring in the society back in, we can see there are 3 points. First of all, state building, society building is both a challenge and response to state-centered policy formation. The second, society building is one of the collaboration mechanisms to improve governance in China. I want to say a few words about this. We have the first sector, government, the second sector, market, and the third sector, civil society organizations. In China, the third sector is still characterized as being far from well-development. So social construction and social management are taken as important mechanism to enhancing governability of Chinese social development. And attempting to move activities from state sector to private market and subsequently from state and market to civil society, China is finding alternative ways to make governance work. Thirdly, the growing enthusiasm of citizen civic engagement and political participation in social affairs is reshaping state and society relationships. So that's why society building is important in China now. How society is built in China? I think we can explain from two aspects. The first is social service delivery. Building a service-oriented, responsible, law-abiding, and clean government is a new goal for administrative reform in China now. As what Professor Yu mentioned above. And if we look at the 11th five-year plan and the 12th five-year plan, we can see social development have a large part in this because of time limitation. I will not put some figures in it. This is for the social service delivery. Since 2006, China has drafted a law on the philanthropy and now is normalized so-called charity industry, and it's foster caring organs with care as well. And the 12th five-year plan put a large effort on it. So this is one aspect. The other aspect is for the civic organizations. Mechanism of self-governance is more and more important in China. Nowadays, we have two mechanisms. One is communities for self-governance. The other is civic organizations. What I want to mention here is NGOs. That means social organizations, private, non-profit organization and foundations. That's the three types of NGOs in China today. The development of NGOs in China emerged from three important periods. The first period is from 1978 to 1989. That's resuming and emerging time. And the third period is from 1992 to 1998. That's emerging nationwide. And then from 2000 up to now, it's delivering and accounting time. That means social delivery and try to make the society accountable, make the government accountable is what they are persuading. So that's the basic picture of social development in China. But what to be done for social building, for society building? The significant growth of non-government organizations and their increasing role in social service delivery have demonstrated their positive role in political development. Society building needs to provide safeguard for citizens' happiness and safety, and to achieve a harmonious society. Many things have to be done, but two efforts have to be made in the near future. On one hand, society building is necessary to the separation of government, market, and the third sector. State initiate to accelerate the separation of functions of the government from those of enterprise, etc., like what Professor Lipso mentioned just now. However, the state has to improve the dynamics, mechanics of people's self-governance in social development to leave space for social organizations to put self-management, self-service, self-education, and self-oversight into practice. That means how to separate government from NGOs or some social organization is another step for the separation. This is one hand. On the other hand, society building is necessary to avoid failure problems. Nowadays, we have market failure, government failure, voluntary failure, many failures now. But the voluntary failure is facing contemporary China. Although booming after reform and opening up, China's NGO are still characterized as not well developed. Some of them make mistakes or even become instrument for crime against the expectation of society. While the public have been gradually aware of the social responsibility of NGOs. So these watchdogs that monitor the accountability of other sectors have been increasingly demanding of responsibility for what they purport to their entitlement. NGOs are still seen as lacking of accountability, and their roles in the country's development is not completely trusted by the public with the increasing account of recent cases. Because of time limit, I don't want to mention too much, like the football corruption in China and some other things. So this is a problem. Try to avoiding such kind of failure is very important. The third one, third part, trust building, an unbounded mission. Why trust building? I think most of us know a lot of trust is essential to state legitimacy. Trust contributes to a great deal of the well-ordered society. You know, trust building is essential to conflict resolution. And appropriate functioning of general principles in public governance needs trust. So trust provides good governance with accountability. That's very important. That's why trust building. How trust is built how trust building is undergoing in China now. I think there are things I put here. The first one is creating public values with social harmony. That's trying to build harmonious society after 2006. And then provide good governance with accountability, what Professor Yu mentioned. I will not repeat. And then promote civic organizations with self-governance, what I mentioned above. And finally, engage citizens in public life with civility. One more thing I want to say about the last point is the 2008 is very important for this point because of the Wenchuan earthquake and 2008 Beijing Olympic Games. The voluntary spirit is spread all over China, so that's a very important point for engaging citizens in public life with civilities. That's the building of trust in China. But what beyond trust building? That's very important. I think to take public governance seriously and from trust to accountability is very important. Finally, only one word I want to say. All in all, just like what Fukuyama discovered from the region of political order, nation did not find stability or sustained prosperity until they became accountable to their citizens. Maybe this is one of the iron law of state-society relations. Thank you very much.
I want to thank Ken and Cheng for inviting me to this workshop, and I will be a little bit more specific about what I'm going to talk about today in terms of state-society relations in China. I'm going to focus on workers and their relationship to the state and how that's changed over the last several years. I want to frame it by talking about three contexts that have really shifted dramatically in the last decade. Some of the things that Ken mentioned in his talk about the demographic changes I think are the most important, but there are also changes that have more to do with the social transformation of new migrant workers and also the political context under the Hu Wen administration starting in 2003. The demographic shifts, I do think, are the most significant because it's really changing the market or the bargaining power of Chinese workers. And this is the foundation for the mobilization of workers recently, this sense that they have more bargaining power vis-a-vis employers. And this has a lot to do with the changing demographics of Chinese society. Generally, reduction in the working population, the aging of Chinese society. But it has also has something to do with some of the policies that have been taken by the government since the financial crisis, the very large domestic stimulus package that stimulated a lot of infrastructure development in inland China, and some of the agricultural policy changes put in place under the Hu Wen administration have also made it more desirable for migrants, and these are rural people who have left their rural registered homeland to work in a urban area, to make it more attractive to stay in the same province, perhaps even to stay in the same general locality, rather than going to the coast, particularly going to Guangdong, the Pearl River Delta, or to Shanghai, or the Yangtze River Delta. A third change related to these demographic shift are the continued barriers to permanent migration for many migrant workers, particularly migrant workers who don't have high skills or high education. And this is also creating a bottleneck or a kind of some kind of barrier to permanent urbanization of these migrants. I know a lot of policies have changed recently that have sped up urbanization, and in some cities, particularly smaller cities, have become more open to migrant workers. But for the large coastal cities, these barriers remain. A lot of the changes in the demographic and these shifts that I'm mentioning came out in surveys that were done even during the financial crisis. So even though China was experiencing big shocks in their export markets, surveys that were done at the time by the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, by the People's Bank of China, and the National Bureau of Statistics all demonstrated actually that wages continued to go up and that migrant workers in general fared pretty well during the crisis, even though many of them were laid off temporarily when exports plummeted in late 2008 and early 2009. And since that time, the economy has recovered, and we see, again, increasing reports of migrant labor shortages in coastal provinces, particularly in labor-intensive manufacturing. The second shift, and this is related, I think, to some of these demographic changes, is really more about the culture of migrant workers, what migrant workers want, what their values are, what their expectations are. There's a lot of talk in China now about this new generation of migrant workers and who they are, what they're like, how they're different from their older brothers and sisters or from their parents, who, if their parents spent some time outside their rural hometowns. Lots of surveys of migrant workers show that they are indeed much better educated than the earlier generation. They tend to be one coming from families with only one child. And they, because of these changes in their education and in their family background, they are much more aware of their rights, and they have different expectations about who they compare themselves to. Their reference is no longer what would have happened to me had I stayed in the countryside. It's about comparing themselves to other young urban people. So they have this frame of reference that is much more equivalent to urban youth. My non-scientific test for this is the hairstyle test. If they have a hairstyle. Then, and this is a picture from a Shanghai NGO event for migrant workers. And so when migrant workers have hairstyles like this, they have different aspirations. They have expensive aspirations. And in some of the research that's been done since the strikes that occurred last spring in a lot of automotive factories and automotive supplier factories, again, show this increasing rights consciousness of young migrant workers. These are pictures from the first strike in Nanhai in Guangdong province. Honda workers were well organized during the strike, even though the strike occurred sort of spontaneously. And they used certain tactics to both organize themselves and also to try to protect their identity from management and from the government. Again, in talking about frames of reference or expectations, these workers very deliberately made comparisons to other workers. They made comparisons to Japanese workers who work for Honda. They made comparisons across different plants that were all within the Honda chain of supply chain. And so they were really looking at other workers around them who might differ by education or by skill or by nationality, but again, trying to press for better treatment. The strikes were relatively peaceful, and they emphasized processes of representation for workers to come forward eventually and bargain with management. And this same factory actually this year has reached a collective bargain that is leading to a fairly significant new increase in salaries. One of the demands that they also made in addition to wages were that they have their own trade union. They didn't exactly ask for an independent trade union, but they did ask for their own trade union, a trade union that would represent their rights. And domestic media coverage of the strikes continued for several weeks. It was finally clamped down on late, about a month into the strikes, but it did facilitate cross-regional spread of strikes in similar factories, often foreign-invested automotive supply factories. And negotiations of the strikes in the end were not handled really by the trade union, but through direct negotiation of a Honda CEO manager and a representative for the workers who ended up being a professor of labor relations, a very limited trade union role, which I'll return to later. So to get to the final changing context, and this is really the political context, this is something that is seen in the policies of the Hu Wen administration. I guess this is the Tuan Pai emphasis on improving the problems with inequality, protecting migrant workers, starting to forcefully draft and then implement new labor legislation that's more protective of workers. And these things I'll talk about all briefly. So in 2007, this was called the Year of Social Legislation. There were three major employment laws that were passed. The labor contract law received probably the most attention, and it is probably the most important law for labor relations in China currently. But also the labor dispute mediation and arbitration law, which actually lowered fees significantly for workers in bringing a suit against their employer. And then the employment promotion law, which paid attention to discrimination issues. This was covered, again, very widely in the Chinese media. This is Zhang Yin. She's one of the famous, one of the most famous Chinese entrepreneurs, the Jiulong paper. She is criticized the law for various reasons and then was herself criticized in the media for her opinions. They also, and this goes to this increased transparency and public participation in lawmaking in China, labor contract law had a period of public comment in 2006. It received 191,000 comments total in 30 days, by far more than any other law in recent PRC history, more than the property law and other controversial laws. And again, demonstrating not only the media's attention to these new laws, but also people in society generally. The government has also been very forthright about its desire, really, it's really a command that local governments continually raise the minimum wage in major cities. And if you look at some of the cities in this chart, you see a fairly significant increase since 2005. And again, going up, it's already been announced. Some of these cities have announced new increases for 2011. Still fairly low minimum wages if you think about what the average salary of a worker in these cities is, but still significant increases. And this is, again, part of the political context of the government's increased support for better protection. The media has played a really important role, often by demonstrating and giving demonstrating what's possible, and also giving people almost false hope about what you can actually achieve through the legal system or through the administrative system of labor dispute resolution. But it still is continuing to play a large role in mobilizing people. And this is just from last couple of days reports in the Chinese media in Chongqing, so it's also a Bo Xilai, maybe populist move, intervening directly in migrant workers' wage arrears. This is something that Wen Jiabao did in 2003, also received a lot of attention. Bo Xilai is doing it in Chongqing. He actually used the Tujing, the SWAT team, to go in and get these migrant workers paid. Of course, according to the media reports, it happened because the head of the special police in Chongqing had been beaten up himself by one of these construction managers. And so it was really more of a personal conflict between two elites that led to the payment of migrant worker wages. But again, it's not insignificant when this is covered in the domestic Chinese media. I want to switch now to talk about some of the problems, and this is a kind of more pessimistic view of how far China can go in changing its representation of workers' interest, and how little has actually changed. We see a lot of the context changing. We see mobilization increasing. We see increased awareness by society. We see increased media reporting. But the actual political changes are less significant than they could be. And this is particularly related to the trade union. So the trade union has been given enhanced power under the Hu Wen administration. A lot of this power is more administrative rather than legal. They've been given increased political space at the top to mobilize. But with the Honda strikes, for example, and this is a picture that was widely circulated in the Chinese media, the local district trade union was sent down to deal with the strike and ended up getting into a fisticuffs with the workers. The guys with the yellow caps are from the local trade union. They were trying to take pictures of the workers, and the workers objected to having their pictures taken. And in theory, there's a lot of differences of course, in terms of how the trade union functions in practice versus how it functions in theory in the trade union law and in other administrative regulations. In theory, it should be democratically elected from the workforce. In practice, still often appointed by management, often from within the HR division. In theory, has the right to sit in on any meeting that affects worker welfare. In practice, is often passive or non-existent in many firms. In theory, has the right to stop production if unsafe. In practice, and you saw this in the Honda strikes, acts as the representative of management during disputes. And increasingly, this the government has put most emphasis on the right to engage in collective bargaining, right? And this is the big push for interest representation, collective representation of labor. In practice, collective contracts were expanding rapidly. You hear more and more of them being signed, often mirror either minimum local standards or government set targets rather than a bargain between the two sides. A lot of these issues come down to the structure, the political structure of the trade union in China. There is a single trade union. It is an umbrella system led by the ACFTU at the top. And the trade union is I lost those 3 minutes so quickly. And it's also, though, however, related to what Ken was mentioning in terms of the incentive structure of local officials. Local officials are mobilized to boost GDP, local economic growth, and boost local GDP. And protecting workers, allowing wages to go up, enforcing some of these very protective new laws often flies in the face of these incentives. And those incentives have not shifted dramatically. And so it continues to be the case that despite the changes, workers do not have confidence in the trade union to represent their interests and see it more as either a tool of management or as a tool of the local government to crack down on strikes. So ironically, what you find instead is that harmonious policies or policies that are pursuing a harmonious society have engendered more social conflict. And this is a picture from the most recent highly publicized strike in the Shanghai port. Since 2008, the labor contract law, labor disputes have doubled in China. Collective labor disputes now are often accompanied by work actions, strikes, stoppages, blocking traffic. And the rate of increase has slowed down since 2008, but 2009 labor disputes are about at the same level of about 700,000 per year. These aren't necessarily strikes. These are legal, sort of administrative and then later legal disputes. And they're highly concentrated in some places, mainly coastal cities and coastal provinces with large labor-intensive manufacturing sectors. With the strikes last year, there's a debate, I think, in among people who study Chinese labor whether or not this was a strike wave, whether or not we'll see these strikes continue or pop up again. And I think it's still too early, really, to tell whether or not that's going to happen, given how concerned the government is with stability and how quickly they're working to nip them in the bud now. But you do see increased willingness on the part of workers to mobilize collectively. Sometimes collective mobilization happens through the assistance of NGOs, labor activist NGOs. There's about 75 total now across China. And increasingly, what's interesting, I think, about NGOs is that some of them now are founded by migrant workers themselves, former migrant workers setting up small grassroots NGOs, receiving some legal training, maybe getting a little bit of foundation money, and then beginning to do outreach and do legal aid and education, rather than the old model, which was much more from the university or from a foreign foundation starting NGOs. And also labor activists, these may be more individual people doing citizen representation of workers. This is something that's allowable in Chinese law. Workplace organizers of strikes, these are workers who have had a lot of experience across many factories and then go on to other factories to help organize, and university student groups. I am out of time, so I will just sum up in a minute or two. The government response, I think the government response to what in a sense are the consequences of these changing contexts, the demographic shifts, the political support, the media coverage, the social transformation of new workers. The consequences of this has not been harmony, but rather new social conflict, more social conflict. And the government's response has really been to focus on preserving stability. And in order to preserve stability, it is not about granting more autonomy to labor organizations, to really even the trade union, but rather using direct government intervention in large collective protests to guarantee social stability. This means, of course, that the problem of representation has not been solved, but rather it's the substitute for interest representation has begun to return to government, in direct government intervention into labor relations. So thank you, and sorry I went over.
According to the conference schedule, the topic of my presentation is about interest-based, politics in China. My presentation consists of four parts. The first, a brief description of interest groups in communist China. The second, two different attitudes towards interest groups. The third, a reaction of Chinese government towards interest groups. And the last one is how to look at such kind of practice. So let's begin the first. What does interest group look like in communist China? A background, as mentioned about by a lot of panelists, so I just admitted. I talk about three ways of formation of interest groups. I divided the first category is from within the system. And three subtypes can be divided further. The first is, maybe six. The first, the self-interest of local governments in the process of decentralization. The second is departmental interest of government at the top. The third is state-owned enterprises. And the fourth is a variety of intermediate associations with government background. Actually, most of the organizations before are government agencies. And the next one is mass organizations, official set, as mentioned, the trade union. And next one is marketized media. The second category is from outside the system. New interest groups were emerging in the era of reform and opening up, including first private companies, second non-official associations, and organizations. The third is entrepreneurs. And three, the third category is interest group from abroad. So as I mentioned, joint venture and exclusive business associations and a charter branch of international NGOs. So this is general picture in terms of organization. The second point I wanted to make is the impact of interest groups on policy process in China. I think the influence of IG is all around, especially in policy making and implementation. The case of enact of labor contract law, as mentioned by Mary, 2 years debate. And the second case is a real law is quite long, more than 10 years. And with implementation, the most case is central government's effort to control the overheating price of housing. In most cases, I think central government was obstacled by an interest coalition consists of local governments, banking institutions, and maybe some real estate and some economists and media. So I don't know how to translate in English, but everyone knows what that means. So just a brief conclusion. Chinese China is deeply embedded in interest politics. We cannot understand it if we neglect the influence of interest groups on public policy. Second, the influence of interest groups on public policy is highly imbalanced. Some are so-called strong interest groups, while others have only limited or weak influences. This kind of phenomenon, I think, is largely due to how well the relevant interests are organized. This is very important. And there exist formal and informal institutional limits on free association in current China. However, the expression and articulation of interest is not simply a function of independence and well-organized interest. Why? Due to high-tech and newly emerged public space. The interest politics, the process of interest politics in China becomes complicated. In some cases, the weak group's interest can be represented with the help of government, media, intellectuals, and public opinions. So although interest groups are actively involved in policy process, and generally speaking, the government has a final say. So part two, how to deal with IG. 7-point consensus agreement on interest-based politics among Chinese scholars and government officials. One, first, interest structure have changed fundamentally with the transition from planned economy to market economy. Second, under such a condition, China is and will be experiencing a period of interest conflicts. Third, in most cases, interest conflict goes along with basic goals, we call it material interest, thus among people, not between people and enemy, according to official ideology. Fourth, the existing interest coordinating mechanism is facing severe challenges from economic transition and the interest differentiation. The fifth, generally speaking, the social and political stability can be maintained in coming future. However, the pressure from society will increase and the cost for maintaining social order is very high. Sixth, a new kind of interest coordinating mechanism should be established in coping with these challenges. The seventh, the goal is to build up a harmonious society. So till now, we have consensus. But two divergent views are the new interest coordinating mechanism. The first, I named it policy-oriented view, arguing for free association, letting interest groups compete fully, check and balance, etc. In its recent report, a research group based on Tsinghua University, actually my colleagues, suggests that six sub-mechanisms should be set up in order to fulfill this goal. Now, quick. Mechanism for information acquiring based on the principle of publicity of information. Mechanism for organizing interest based on free association. Mechanism for interest expression based on citizen participation and free media. And mechanism for imposing pressure channel so people can rally, strike, parade, and petition, etc. Mechanism for interest coordinating, that is, rational dialogue and negotiation between interest groups. The last one is mechanism for mediation and arbitration. An independent judicial agency is needed. And the second response by government, which are called conservative view, a neutral sense, strengthening the adjustment and adaptation within the framework of existing political system. This is the very standpoint adopted by the government. So part three, let's talk about what government do. Theory and ideological dimension, the attitude toward interest group from positive to negative. The term interest group was first used by top leader on March 15, 1988, Cao Ziyang, the general party secretary, in his working report. The contradiction between interest groups among Chinese people will exist even under socialist institution. However, more than 10 years later, when this term reappeared in party or government document, it became a negative one. In his famous speech delivered July 1st, 10 years ago, Jiang Zemin pointed out, we never allow the exercise of public power for private purposes, and never allow the formation of vested interest group. Against pluralism proposition, instead stressing the party government laid protection of mass interest. This last one is, this argument presumes that the CCP and government stand above the society. Thus, two statements are deduced logically. The first is prevention of government agencies be turned into vested interest group. The second is CCP as an exclusive ruling party should represent the whole society. Actually, this is one of the key points made by President Jiang. Political measures dimension. I just list some of them. Deliberative management and control of all social organizations, double management system, selective strategy, a permit of CCP, and resource dependency strategy. Second, adjustment of important public policy and revision of law, abolishing penalty tax and other fees nationwide, strengthening the function of trade union in order to protect the rights of workers, and develop a strategy adjusted on national level from GDPism to inclusive development. So in this sense, the 12th five-year plan maybe is a turning point. Improve social welfare, gradually trying to reduce the huge gap between the poor and the rich, improve the living condition of the weak social groups, and improve policy process, enhancing the quality of decision-making in a democratic and scientific way, through more participation by experts, both local and top level, and ordinary people on local level. Public discussion on selective hot issues through media. Make a service-oriented government. By doing this, governments at different levels try to close its tie with people and establish a mechanism of demand, reaction, or response between government and people in policy domain. In a political system, lacking free election, which creates so-called anticipated reaction, such practices are crucial for functioning of the system. To some extent, it can be viewed as a very important functional substitute for election at this moment, in terms of dynamic relations between people and government. So last part, how to look at the practice of Chinese government. A sharp difference between Chinese interest group politics and that of USA. So I'm just puzzled. Is interest group politics a right word to describe what happened in China? In China today. Second, interest-based politics is greatly shaped by the nature of relationship between state and society in current China. And more Chinese scholars begin to realize that the forming of Chinese society is under the umbrella of government, which is a similar feature of capitalism instead of civil society and pluralism. So several questions need to be answered, but not agreement reached yet. The first one is, to what extent can we say that the practice of Chan-an is effective or not? Second, is it a temporary phenomenon or a new forming pattern with Chinese characteristics? Three, the third, is a party state compatible with an interest-differentiated society based on market economy, or how far can it travel without fundamental reform? The fourth, whether or not all these differentiated social interests can find their representations within the CCP, thus stimulate, foster, or promote the intra-party democracy. The answer to these questions, in my point of view, do not exist in textbooks nor mainstream theories of social science today. So more attention should be paid to the evolution process of the Chinese party state in terms of interactions between challenges and the reactions in which the learning ability of CCP plays a key role. So this is just a picture. The moving of the party state's pattern, just like a sway. So version A is mass error, version B is dense error. Up to now, we knew quite well about version A of Chinese party state. However, it is hard to say we have clear ideas about where the version B is and what it is and will be like. So personally, I prefer an open mind stand by considering what is ongoing in China as an unprecedented social experiment in the context of globalization with its long history tradition. Thank you.
I think that you will agree that we've had three very rich presentations. They stimulated, in my mind, a lot of questions, but I'm going to be generous to the audience and not ask my questions to give you more time. And we don't really have very much time. We have maybe 15 minutes. So the floor is open, and I see my colleague Tuan there with the first question.
Thank you, Richard. My name is Tuan from Synapse, Brookings. I have two questions for Chinese colleagues, very quick one. The first one is, do you have any laws governing the formation and activities of non-governmental organizations in China? Second question is, what is the role of the think tanks in China? As far as I know, you have more than 500 think tanks now, and the number keep on growing. So what is the role of think tanks? Thank you.
I'd rather speak in Chinese, okay. 我来回答第一个问题，关于这个有关社会组织的法律，到目前为止还没有一个完整的法律存在，但是呢，有一些条例，政府的条例，现在有三个条例，就是分别针对中国NGO 的三个不同的这个类型，一个呢是关于就是社会组织的，第二个呢是关于民办非企业的，第三个呢是关于基金会的。那么这三个呢都是在中国民政部登记的类别，那么这三个类别分别有条例来规范。但是统一的法律现在正在起草的中，但是没有完整的这个法律存在。当然，我刚才也提。
Let me answer the questions regarding NGO legislation in China. Currently, there's no comprehensive or completed legislation in this particular aspect, but we have a number of regulations and the rules. Particularly, there are three major regulations. Corresponding to different types of NGO in China. These are the three major different types of NGO in China. You know that NGOs will have to register with the Ministry of Civil Affairs in China. So there are basic three types. First is the social organization, And the second type is the private and non-enterprise or non-corporate organization. The third is the foundation. So corresponding to the three major types, they are regulations and rules regarding its organization and operation.
除去这三个条例之外呢, 还有一些相关的这个法律也在起草，还有一些规定。 还有民间组织自己制定的一些类似于行业规范的或者叫code之类的，你比如说慈善法现在正在制定过程中，还有一个呢就是NGO在前几年呢，他们自己有60多家吧，搞了一个行业自律的规定，这个具体的名字我现在说不太清楚，它有这么一个就是。 不是政府做的，不是法律，但是也是一个规范，也属于norms。他们专门有这么一个自律的规定，所以整个规范体系是正在建设之中。我想这也是制度化的一个表现。Well,
other than the related government rules and regulations, there are also other laws. Or other norms and codes established by these organizations themselves, they are considered the trade codes or trade norms. And for example, the charity law is under construction. And also, we've seen that about 60 NGOs, they have got together and come up with their own disciplines and bylaws. And overall, I think we see emergence of legal framework in this particular aspect.
充一点，那个就中国的好多事情，它现在这个法治正在建设过程当中，所以它好多特征就是跟西方社会它可能差别会很大，就我们整个中国的改革过程是首先做，做了好肯定，然后再修改法律，所以这是中国的特点。Well,
as you see, that China is currently constructing a legal society. And the current practice, as you see, is we practice first, and then if it's a good practice, and it will inform good policy or good law. So it's the order that you do not see in the West. And that's also very different from the Western legal framework.
第二个呢，就是讲到那个思想库，现在思想库发展其实挺快的，官方的有很多，其实民间的也不少，但现在我觉得现在有一点我觉得很奇怪，我最近开了几次会议，发现一个很有趣的现象。 他们现在有个词不叫社团，因为一讲社团你就要登记，不登记你就非法，所以他们有个词叫社群。Well,
as to the think tanks in China, they are developing very fast. We see official think tanks and also private think tanks. And based on my observation and experience with them, I noticed a very interesting phenomena. Usually, what people would avoid using the term "社团," which probably means a social organization. But if you call yourself a social organization, you have to go get registered. So in order to avoid that, they come up with a different term, which is "社群," probably means a social group.
从长远的趋势来看，我觉得随着法治社会的建设，随着社团，我非常赞同于可平的观点，就中国的复光中国的公民社会，它肯定要成长，后面加个词"中国特色"，然后这个法律也会完善，这方面总的趋势来讲，这个过程很明显，但尽管现在内部有争论，官员也有争论，但这个总的趋势我想是不可避免的。I
think the long-term general trend in current Chinese society is that the civil society will continue to emerge and grow and be strengthened. And at the same time, we see the construction or building of the rule of law, and that is also taking place gradually in China, and that's the long-term prospect.
Please identify yourself.
My name is Zheng Wang. I'm a senior fellow of U.S. Institute of Peace. I want to ask Dr. Shi to elaborate a little bit more about what you mentioned about social management. You mentioned about it's a hot topic recently, and also I think Dr. Yu also mentioned there are quite high-level training workshops on social management, 社会管理. So how do we understand this new emphasis on social management? Why the government launched this new program at this time, and in connections with what happened in the Middle East, or What kind of content, what kind of plan the government has to improve or strengthen social management? Mainly offering courses for the senior officials or are there any plans? Thank you.
Thank you. Professor Scher.
社会管理在中国确实是一个很新的词汇，我想在咱们学术界也是比较特殊的，也是有中国特色的一个词汇。那么其实社会管理跟公共服务在中国或者叫这个 social service delivery 这个社会服务这两项在中国呢是从不同的维度来说相似的问题。其实就是我们一再强调的这个在中国所面临的一系列的社会发展的问题，也包括公共服务、公共安全等等各个方面，不过各有侧重。那么公共服务呢，主要是讲这个供给问题，这个delivery这个方面。那么社会管理呢，它更着重于从政府治理的角度来回答这个问题，而且呢，就像你刚才提到的。 其实社会管理可能更多的是从社会秩序的角度来对这个问题进行规范。那么实际上社会管理它除去在这个服务领域在做好相关的这个管理层工作之外，对于这个社会的稳定工作呢，这里边包括公共安全相关的事物呢会更侧重一些。那么实际上我个人考虑 有点类似于咱们美国，像你是从这个和平研究所来的，那么有点类似于咱们这个 conflict management， 但是它又不局限于 conflict management 或者 conflict resolution 之类的东西。那么甚至包括像应急管理、公共卫生安全等等这一系列的，它都包括在这个社会管理内容之一。所以
，Could you let the interpreter please translate?
Sorry.
Social management is a very new concept in political science, and also in academia, it's a very special term or special vocabulary with Chinese characteristics. And in our understanding, actually, social management and public service delivery or public service delivery, these or public security, public safety, these are actually different approaches or perspectives addressing very similar problems, very similar social problems, but each one of them has a different focus or different emphasis. And for example, public service delivery is more focusing on the delivering of public service to the general public, and social management is more on the governance side and for the maintenance of the order and stability of the society. And also it has an emphasis on guarantee or ensuring the public safety. It's probably somehow similar to a term in conflict management here in Western scholarship. It's very similar to crisis management or conflict resolution.
我再补充一句，但是呢，它又不局限于这个类似于我们美国这边讲的 conflict management， 它还包括其他一些不属于 conflict。 你像这个户籍管理，现在正在改革。那么社会管理在中国一个很重要的任务就是包括这个户籍管理改革的问题。大家都知道，户籍制度是中国一个非常特殊的这个社会管理制度。那么这次社会管理改革呢？ 其实很大程度上也包括这方面的内容。
Okay. Other than sharing some similarities with the concept of conflict management or conflict resolution in the Western scholarship, social management, the concept itself in China also encompasses many other aspects, for example, the household registration reform and the management of the household, and that's household registration. This is a very special phenomenon in China. So social management reform includes that particular aspect of how to reform and or better this the household registration system.
当然，最后一句话也包括刚才第一个问题提到的，比如说对于 NGO 的立法与管理，这也是社会管理的重要内容。
And also, we go back to the first question in terms of the legislation related to NGO, and that's also under the purview of social management.
Mary has a comment.
I wanted to say something about...
Turn on your mic.
Thanks. About social management, since it's also related to what I was talking about at the end of my talk about how the government now thinks about management of large-scale collective labor protests or strikes. And one of the things that this is around the whole idea of preserving stability or having some kind of stability preservation committees that are intra-government offices. So within a locality, if there's a large-scale protest, actually many different types of government and party units have to come out to the site to manage the conflict. And that might include, for a labor dispute, the trade union, the labor bureau, the police, the local government and party, and maybe some higher representative of the company, if depending on what type of company it is. That has a lot of advantages to the government because it allows it to do a number of different things, and it's a number of different goals that it has. One, it gets those keeps those labor disputes out of the court system, and this is something that WHO and WEN have been much more supportive of, which is not always using litigious means to resolve labor disputes. And so this is about harmony again, and it's about mediation, sometimes forced mediation, but mediation of large-scale labor disputes. That also means that you can then easily repress the leaders of the strike if they're obvious at the site. So you also get rid of the leadership. And you usually compromise. You give the workers something, so most of the workers leave relatively happy. But so it solves a lot of problems that the government sees. I think the issue with that kind of resolution, I mean, it has some it violates due process under the law, under the labor law, but also it requires huge government investment in social management.
Unfortunately, we've run out of time. We could go on for a long time, I think. I'd like now to turn it over to Ken Lieberthal to close the conference. While he's coming to the stage, please join me in thanking our presenters.
And the audience for being here for the entire afternoon. I know it's a long afternoon. I hope you found it as rewarding as I have listening to it. I again want to thank our funders for this, the CUSEF, based in Hong Kong. And I especially want to thank our Chinese colleagues, both for your participation in this project overall and especially for your coming here today, and Professor Yu in particular for taking the leadership role in all of this. We really appreciate all that you've done to make this a success. I also want to thank the unsung heroes that always help out dramatically in these kinds of meetings, which is the staff of the China Center, who are putting a lot of time on this and have really organized things, I think, very well. I want to remind you that we have two volumes coming out of this project later this year, one in Chinese, one in English. Each will have very extensive papers on each major aspect of the Chinese political system with comments on those papers, and I think they will be worth looking at when they are available. And that is it. Thank you again for coming, and to all the participants.